This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. And today's guest is the author of a book entitled 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours, Lisa Reisman. Lisa Reisman is a Connecticut freelance journalist. She spends her new life, and we'll find out what she means by that, working to highlight people on the Connecticut shoreline who are living inspiring lives, launching new enterprises, and making a difference in the lives of others. Lisa is multi-talented. She also manages the Sin Sisters Band. We'll have to ask her about that. It's a group with a repertoire that ranges from swing to Motown to classic rock. Reisman studied ancient Greek and Latin and law. She practiced law in New York City for 4 years, but her story in our conversation today has very little to do with what her life was about. Lisa Reisman, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Lisa, you've heard me describe you. You are doing many things now. You've done many things in the past. Ancient Greek, some people would say that ancient Greek and law is kind of the same thing, but you've studied ancient Greek, Latin, and
yes,
law. So let's kind of talk about the life that you envisioned for yourself as you were pursuing these courses of study.
Sure. Well, the truth is I didn't know what I wanted to do. To be. In college, I thought I wanted to be a lexicographer. I thought I wanted to write dictionaries. I had always had a knack for ancient Greek and Latin, in particular, translating into English. I was accepted to a graduate program to study classics. I lasted 2 years, and I looked at my classmates and saw how much more dedicated they were than I was, and I also couldn't see myself spending my life in a carrel studying ancient texts. So because I suffered from a total lack of imagination and because my father was in the legal profession, I decided to go to law school.
And what was law school like for you?
Law school was fun. Practicing law was great at the beginning. It seemed very glamorous to me to have a office on the 32nd floor and a secretary and Lincoln Town Cars home, and until the 18-hour days became very tiresome and I began to wear down, and I began to realize that redistributing wealth among Fortune 500 companies wasn't what I wanted to do with my life.
Well, but you know, you're right. For many people, I mean, you were a New York City attorney. You were,
yep,
in a lot of ways at the what is the pinnacle of success for many people. 32nd floor, secretary, town cars, doesn't get better than that. So it takes you 18 hours a day. Who cares? It doesn't get better than that. But
yeah, right. Go ahead.
For you, at some point, you decided to walk away from all of that.
You're right. I did.
Why?
Well, as I said, I couldn't envision spending my life with these 18-hour days, and I knew that making partner would only increase the workload. And also, to be quite honest, I wasn't a very talented lawyer. The way that I kept myself employed was by writing better than everyone else. I would be the person people would come to if they needed a brief written or a motion or a memo. But I think in a law firm, there are people who are great talkers and that there are people who can write. And I certainly wasn't very good at convincing opposing counsel to go one course and that kind of thing.
Okay. So when you say you weren't a very talented lawyer, your verbal communication skills were not on par with many of your colleagues. Your written communication skills, astounding, it sounds like.
I wouldn't say astounding, but I think they were strong enough to be better than most. And I would look at some of my colleagues and see how quickly their minds worked, and it was really astonishing. And I also knew my limitations, and I knew that I would never be, I could never, I was not the type to be buttonholing clients, and I didn't have the aptitude to stand in front of a jury and try to sway them to our side. So when I saw that, and when I decided that I didn't want to spend my life doing practicing law, I didn't know what to do next.
Well, in a lot of ways, the kind of law that you're describing, you really have to be an excellent salesperson, and that was not for you.
Precisely.
So on August 1st of 1998, what was your plan?
I had resigned from my firm. I had 1 week remaining. That was a Saturday. My plan was to buy a lipstick red Plymouth Valiant convertible and drive around the country until I decided what to do next.
Well, now that's a plan.
That's a plan.
All right, and it had to be lipstick red, and it had to be a convertible.
Well, I had already zeroed in on it. So I was going to, once I had my last day of work, I was going to go that next weekend and buy it.
And so what happened?
What happened was I went for a 5-mile run that Saturday, August 1st, 1998 day. In the morning, I had a call from my sister who lives in Baltimore. We talked every Saturday morning, and I was spent because it was a very hot August day. Mm. I told my sister I would call her back when I got up that I needed to take a nap, and that's the last I remember. The next thing I remember is waking up in a hospital room and being told I had a brain tumor.
That is just breathtaking. I mean, you lived it. For those listening who are trying to imagine it, I mean, that's just breathtaking. You're on your way to your lipstick red convertible, and you wind up in the hospital with a brain tumor?
Yep.
What went through your brain at that point?
Well, it's odd, because I had suffered a massive seizure that Saturday. I had never called my sister back, obviously. So I was still in a haze, and when the doctor told me I had a brain tumor, I was more annoyed than anything at the way he was speaking to me, because he was pronouncing every single syllable, and I thought, why is he talking to me like I'm some kind of halfwit? And when it registered, the first thing I said was, well, let's just get it out. Let's do it. That seemed to me, in my sort of fragile state of mind, the most easy and quick resolution.
And that's almost consistent with sort of a New York way of life, or at least how people think about it. You know, it's a problem, let's just get it done. Let's just get it over with.
That's a great point. I hadn't thought of that.
When you said, let's just get it done,
yep.
How much awareness, as you look back on it, did you really have of what let's get it done really meant?
I think I had very, very little awareness. And as I look back, I actually feel fortunate that only 2 days elapsed between learning that I had a brain tumor and learning that I would have to have brain surgery. If I had had 2 weeks, it would have been immeasurably harder to imagine my brain, my head being cut open and my brain's being tinkered with. So I think because I had so little time to sort of process what was happening, that perversely made it easier.
Now, for you, the notion was, all right, let's just get it done. Let's get it over with. Did the doctors indicate that there was an urgency to dealing with this?
They didn't indicate an urgency, but they did say just the fact that the surgery had to be done 2 days later implied an urgency.
All right, so they weren't really giving you information at that point. They were just doing what they felt they needed to do?
Exactly. I think for the kind of brain tumor I had, they saw a brain tumor in the right frontal lobe of my brain on the MRI, but they didn't know if it was benign or malignant. So they had to actually take the tumor out of my brain and then send it to the pathology lab to get it analyzed.
So at this point, all you know is that you've got a tumor. It's in your brain, which is scary just in and of itself. I mean, people don't like to think about something like that. Did you have an opportunity to call family or friends, or were you on your own? What was going on?
My whole family was there because what happened was when I failed to call back my sister by Saturday night, my family became quite alarmed. And they first they tried to reach my landlord. He was away for the week. My super didn't have a copy of my keys. My sister and my father, my father was in New Haven. My sister was in Baltimore. They split up all the emergency rooms in New York City. I had not been admitted to any of them. The NYPD refused to break into my apartment because I had not been missing for 72 hours. Mm-hmm. That would have taken us into Tuesday, by which time I would have been dead. So they had, and by Monday morning, my sister in Baltimore was the only one who had a set of my keys. She sent the keys up. She went to the Amtrak station, put the keys on the Amtrak Package Express first thing Monday morning. About my stepmother picked up the set of keys, went to my apartment, and that's where she found me in my bedroom unconscious.
That's
why my family they didn't want to believe something was wrong, but when they heard from my stepmother that there was, everyone just rushed to New York.
That's extraordinary the way that all happened. I mean, so many times you say you're going to call your sister back and you don't, and the assumption is she fell asleep. She'll talk to me when she talks to me. Your sister had a connection to you that was so strong that she knew if you didn't call back, something was up.
You're right. Yep.
In a lot of ways, that connection saved your life.
I think that's exactly true. And I think, a lot of people saved my life, but she was the first, and definitely.
Folks, you are listening to the voice of Lisa Reisman. Lisa is the author of 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours. We have just learned that Lisa, after being unconscious, was ultimately rushed to a hospital and discovered that she had a brain tumor. Lisa, you had 2 days after you were in the hospital, the tumor had been removed. What did you then discover? What were you told after they took a look at the tumor in more detail?
I learned from the surgeon that I had what's called a glioblastoma multiforme grade 4, which is pretty much, I learned, the baddest brain tumor out there. I did not know the prognosis for several years by choice, but what I learned much later was that I basically had a year to live.
Huh.
And on the outside, no one, I guess at the time, survived beyond 5 years.
And this was in 1998?
This was in 1998, yes.
So I'm wondering if you can talk about that moment when, not knowing what the prognosis was, but hearing that you had a significant issue, grade 4 glioblastoma, what went through your mind at that point?
Well, at first, I heard grade four, and my sister and my brother-in-law are both physicians, and I thought I remembered her telling me that grade four was better. So I for a moment, I thought that was better, like it's a higher grade, like a higher test score.
Gotcha.
And then I heard the doctor say, "I'm sorry," and then I looked at my family, and I saw my sister's face, which just looked like it had dropped, and I saw my father. Everyone looked sort of stunned, so I knew it wasn't good. And then that felt like a punch in the gut.
I would think so. The days immediately after that, what talk to us about, you write about this in your book, talk to us about what life was like for you.
I spent the first week at my stepmother's New York apartment, and I was in a haze. People were calling, ringing and seeing how I was doing. Most people wanted to know what I had gone through, and people were being extraordinarily supportive. I had an odd conversation with a man named Bob. My sister had set this all up, and she thought it would help me because he had the same brain tumor as I was, as I did. And it ended up, he sort of told me the horror stories of what he was going through, and then after that, I told my sister no more of those calls.
Yeah, no more Bob, right?
No more Bob. Yeah.
When you heard him tell you his horror stories, did you assume that you would be going through that as well, or did you think, well, that's just him, I'll be different?
I think I probably assumed that I would. I had no context.
Okay.
So I had no idea what I would go through. So what he was telling me was my first information. So I probably assumed that all would happen to me as well. And the thing that scared me the most, I remember, is when he talked about how he had lost his memory and how his mind seemed to be going. Because, I mean, my mind was all I had.
Right.
You know? So, yeah.
And even though you didn't have a clear picture of what you wanted to sort of do when you grew up, all of your studying and all of your work was very much an engagement of the mind.
Precisely.
So for him to tell you that he was losing his memory, I can't even begin to imagine what that was like. Just the idea for anybody that they're losing their memory is, as we well know, that's really scary for folks.
Yes.
Was it helpful for you that people were calling to find out how you were and what you'd gone through?
For the most part, yes. It felt very good when people were coming through and then asking me how I was. Sometimes I'd hang up the phone in gagging disgust when people would sort of ring for me the most horrid details of my ordeal.
Mm.
But for the most part, it felt really good. I felt almost as if I were being eulogized and I was still alive.
Now, at that point, you still had no idea of what the prognosis was.
I had no idea.
Okay.
No, but I knew it wasn't good.
And that was your intent. You did not want to know. The doctors gave you a choice.
The doctors didn't give me I don't think there was discussion of the prognosis when I got my diagnosis, but from the very beginning, I told my sister and my brother-in-law, please don't tell me my prognosis.
Okay.
And I think it was an impulse toward self-preservation.
Okay. And when you received the diagnosis, you now have been home for about a week. At what point did the treatment process begin, and what was it?
Sure. The treatments began, I think, 2 weeks after I was discharged. The treatments were six weeks of daily radiation treatments and six rounds of chemotherapy every 6 weeks.
For those who aren't clear as to what that actually means, can you walk us through a day?
Sure. I would be... Okay, a day in my life or
a day in your life as you're dealing with the radiation and then the chemo.
Sure.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll find out more about what happened to Lisa on her journey through her life. We'll be right back. We are back. We continue the conversation with Lisa Reisman, who is the author of 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours, and we'll learn about what that means in a little bit. Lisa, you had 2 days after you were in the hospital, the tumor had been removed. What did you then discover? What were you told after they took a look at the tumor in more detail?
So at the beginning, I had these sort of vast wilderness of days because I had no idea what to do with myself. Mm-hmm. I had moved to Connecticut to stay with my mother and have my treatments at Yale. So I felt this urgency to come up with something that I needed to do beyond my treatments, and it took me a long time to come up with activities. But I'll take you through I began my day I hammered out a regimen for myself.
Okay.
So I would go walking.
All right.
And as I walked, I started memorizing poetry because I wanted to make sure my mind stayed strong as well as my body. So I would pick out these poems, for example, Robert Frost, Miles to Go Before I Sleep, and I'd say that as I walked. I'd recite that to myself to remind myself I wasn't going anywhere. So walking was one of the things I did, and then I played piano, and then I practiced meditation. I did crossword puzzles, and then around about 2 o'clock, someone, because my mother was working full time at the time in 1998.
Okay.
All these people would come through. So someone came to and stayed with us. And someone would drive me to radiation.
Okay.
And so the radiation process is you sit in the waiting room, you're called in, and then I think it was about 15 minutes maybe. I can't quite remember how long it was.
Okay.
But you sit, it's almost like an MRI, but they would put this mask over my head, and then my head would be zapped with radiation on the right side. And then I'd go home. I'd probably take a nap, and that's about it.
Were there side effects from the radiation treatments?
There weren't at the beginning, which was quite exhilarating for me because I should say I was in really good shape, and it was just sort of, as my brother-in-law once said, you really excellent below the head health. So And the other part of radiation was I actually loved going to the treatments because the staff and the therapists were so positive and so sunny, and it was sort of the highlight of my day, as odd as that might sound. About 4 weeks after I started losing my hair, and that was not a happy time.
Let me ask you this. Let me just go back to just before you moved to Connecticut. Did you actually shut down your New York apartment, or did you have a sense that you were coming back to New York to your apartment?
I had no idea. I had not yet given up my lease, but that was all. I was going to do all that after my final week of work, which obviously I never had.
Okay. So you still had your apartment, but you were staying in Connecticut. You know, you just made the comment about the highlight of your day being going to treatment. And I think it's so important because you know, there are certainly times when people who work in the healthcare industry day after day, year after year, may forget how important their demeanor is and how impactful the way they treat patients can be to the patient's life and health and recovery. So I think it's really important that you made that observation. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
At some point, your hair began to fall out. What started to happen for you at that point? What kind of thoughts were you having?
Well, at first, I didn't think of, at first, I thought it was an eyelash, and then gradually the hair started falling out, and around in about a 2-week span, it was all gone. But I couldn't, it seemed almost worse than dying in death, as odd as that might sound, because there was no guarantee it would come back. And I remember saying to my sister, so I might have to go through the rest of my life or whatever time I have left with patchy hair on my head. And you know, I'm not so bold and brave as to shave my head. So I couldn't imagine living my life like having to wear a wig. And then I resorted to all these crazy strategies to keep my hair. Like, I stopped shampooing. I started to refer to my hair in the plural. Like, I started to refer to them as hairs to remind myself that each one counted. I really wanted to keep my hair no matter what. Yeah.
You know, I so appreciate certainly you're talking with us today, but also the book, because you've clearly described an experience that people have. You haven't tried to sugarcoat it. You haven't tried to make it better or worse than it was. You have told the truth, and the truth was pretty stunning. The 6 rounds of chemotherapy. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. It was much the same as radiation. The side effects didn't manifest for, I think, the first 2 or 3 rounds. No, the first 2 rounds. And I would after the first 2 rounds, I would go for a run, and that was my way of declaring that the treatments hadn't sapped my strength.
Wow.
Until the 3rd round, when which had to be delayed when I was told my white cell count had dropped too low, so my body couldn't tolerate another round of chemo. And that was really hard to hear, because I mean, when I was sick, I did all these other activities, but the treatments were, I sort of loved the treatments because they were what was stopping the cancer in its tracks. Nothing else I was doing. I mean, I could walk, I could memorize every poem in the canon, but that didn't guarantee that wasn't a sure thing that it was doing anything. But with the treatments, I knew that gave me that gave me a chance.
You know, the internal resilience that you were able to draw upon. I'm thinking about your reciting poetry to yourself to remember at a time where, you know, we were talking about brain exercises and activity, but not nearly so much as we are now. And maintaining the regimen, the exercise regimen. I mean, so many things that one would think would be very hard to do, and yet they were your way of participating in saving your own life. Pretty extraordinary stuff.
That's true, and I would say even beyond that, just doing them every day.
Yes,
it afforded me a sense of control somehow, and it also gave me a sense of calm that I was doing everything I could to stay well, if you play the piano, you understand that if you play a piece and you somehow it's a beautiful piece of music, there's a calm that comes over you,
right.
And that sort of leads to this sensation that of peace, of that everything is going to be okay. So even above and beyond what I did, there were these sort of collateral benefits.
Lisa, you've titled your book 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours. What does that mean? Why?
It means the 5 months refers to the time between when I get my diagnosis in August and an MRI 5 months later in December, when I learned that the cancer has not spread. The 10 years refers to the time after that, when being a survivor of the cancer experience, the years after the cancer was gone were in many ways harder than the struggle against the disease. And then the 2 hours refers to a triathlon I took on to mark my 10-year anniversary of my survival. And the reason that I juxtapose the triathlon, the struggle in the triathlon, and the struggle against my disease is, I think more than a battle, I think anyone surviving, anyone facing a serious illness, particularly cancer, it's more of a marathon than
yes.
a battle.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marathon of treatments, of tests, of more treatments. It's getting through each of those. And I think the triathlon, even though I took it on myself, was the same. I always recall something that my high school cross country coach told me, which was, if a race seems too long, break it down into manageable distances.
Mm.
Have small achievable goals. Just even if it's run telephone by telephone pole. And I think that's the way I got through both my illness and the triathlon.
And, you know, that is such an important piece of wisdom just for life. If it seems
right.
like it's too big, just kind of chunk it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that 5 months later when you get the MRI and you learn the cancer cells had not spread. Now, at that point, you still did not have an awareness of what your prognosis had been determined to be. Is that correct?
I did not, but I knew it was good news.
All right. So did you feel completely relieved and cured? And did you, I mean, what did you do with that information?
For a couple of days, I felt exhilarated. And then I began to think, oh, my God, what next? Because I had focused so intently on my survival for the previous 5 months that I hadn't given any thought to what I would do next. None.
Okay.
So it was sort of a shock. It was an exhilaration, and then, oh, my God, what next?
Now, the doctor also told you that you would have to continue to have follow-up MRIs. Is that correct?
That's right.
And how often did the doctor indicate that would need to happen?
I think it was twice a year for the next 5 years, and then after that it was once a year.
So it doesn't sound like there was an end to it. It just would sort of taper and then be on an even keel.
Well, I mean, I'm 16 years out, and I don't think I've had an MRI for about 6 years. So it did end.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
For the next 10 years, you now had to think about your life in a different way, having gone through something that, even though you weren't aware of the prognosis, you knew it was pretty bad, it was really serious, and it was really intense. How did you spend your next 10 years?
Well, I'll first say that it wasn't just that I survived cancer. I survived a disease that most people aren't supposed to survive. I think
right.
I sensed that even though I didn't quite know my prognosis.
Okay.
So there was this, even being, you know, I was exhilarated that I was alive, of course, but I couldn't quite escape a certain survivor's guilt.
Mm.
Why was I living when so many others had died? So that weighed on me. And there was also this sort of sense of shame because I was 32 years old, and, you know, I didn't the first thing, I didn't want to tell people I had brain cancer. It wasn't mm-hmm. it wasn't something that I wanted to share immediately about myself, but sure. at the same time, I didn't quite know who I was except for a cancer survivor.
Uh-huh.
So it took a long time to figure out how to define myself. I remember, actually, one time I was filling out an online dating, a profile for an online dating site,
mm-hmm.
and I remember not being able to figure out what to write. I was no longer a lawyer. I was in a writing program at Columbia, but I hadn't published anything, so I didn't consider myself a writer. And I certainly didn't want to write down brain cancer survivor. So I just that's when it hit me. I had no idea who I was.
Uh-huh.
Who was I? And I tried to figure that out for years and years and years. The other part of it was that because I had this sense that why had it been me and not, why had I been chosen to live and so many others not, I felt as if I had to do something sort of momentous or dazzling to sort of validate why I was still on Earth.
And was that something that you were just getting from yourself? Was that an internal push, or did you get that sense from people around you?
It was an internal push.
Okay.
I just felt this urgency to do something, and I just it took me so long to figure out what that was.
In the trying to figure it out,
mm-hmm.
did you date? Did you go to therapy or support groups? Did you continue in school? What were some of the ways that you opted to try to figure out just who Lisa was?
Yeah, I did date, but I could never sort of commit to a long-term relationship because I felt somehow there was still sort of the scepter of recurrence that was looming for years after. I mean,
mm-hmm.
16 years out, no longer, I felt sort of still sort of freakish because I had gone through this and I couldn't see how I could be attractive to anyone. So that was sort of in my mind. And as for work, I was very lucky to meet a professor at Columbia at a writing conference who liked, I had been writing about what was happening to me, and she sort of took me under her wing. But so that was something that I could do, but I couldn't get anything published, so I felt very reluctant to even call myself a writer. And the first thing that I wanted to do once I got the clean bill of health was I was sure I wanted to become a nurse.
Okay.
Because the nurses who had treated me were so wonderful, and I had decided that even during the treatments. And then I went and spoke with someone at the Yale School of Nursing, and it just seemed like this was what I was meant to do. And then she talked about this, that I should get some clinical training before I went to nursing school, and my heart dropped because I just couldn't imagine being with sick people again. I just needed to get away from that for a while.
That's interesting that you wanted to be a nurse, but
yes.
being with sick people kind of seemed like a challenge.
Yeah, it seemed too much because I just wanted to be away from that scene for a while.
So you did not pursue nursing, is that correct?
I did not.
What was your next approach? What next career did you take a look at?
Well, I was admitted to the Columbia School of the Arts writing program, and so I thought that was what I was going to do, be a writer, but I really didn't know what that entailed. I never had met a writer before. I mean, in all my 33 years in life, I had no idea. I read books, but I never put a lot of thought into how these books came into being. I never saw someone, sitting at their desk every day for hours and hours and just typing. It wasn't a life that I had been exposed to.
But
so I didn't really, I'm sorry, go
what,
ahead.
What's interesting, though, is that ultimately you were doing what you have been good at doing for much of your lifetime, which is writing.
That's right.
I mean, yep. that's what got you through your law years. You were the one they came to for assistance with writing. And, you know, in so many ways, it seems like it has sort of been your friend, kind of carried you through.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Through the 10 years, as you were trying to figure out what was going on for you, mm-hmm. what were some of the awarenesses that you had, if you had any, about your diagnosis? Was there a time in which you specifically knew that you had been given a year to live?
Definitely, yes. I think I'm quite sure maybe I was writing about it or someone asked me it, but this must have been 6 years after I was diagnosed.
Okay.
And I looked it up, and I'm so glad that I never knew it before, because if I had seen that coming out of my diagnosis, if I had seen those really dire statistics,
right,
I would have been in the fetal position. So yes, I did learn my prognosis. Yes,
eventually. You know, it kind of speaks volumes, though, to the way people think about a prognosis, how much they're willing to accept, how much they're willing to continue to battle through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you had learned your diagnosis and said, well, you know, I guess I'm kind of done, I need to wrap my life up, which is what a lot of people would do, you well might not have been here today.
Yep, I think that's true. And I think I did it my way. I can't say, I can say what worked for me, but I certainly understand when other people want to learn everything they can about their disease. That just wasn't for me.
Gotcha. Which was
yeah.
another thing that I noted, because there are people right now who, if you tell them they have a cold, I mean, they're going to do extensive research on that
mm-hmm.
cold, and almost no more they believe than the doc when they go in. And for you, not so much. You had a name in your head of what this was, but you were more intent on surviving than on researching, it sounds like.
Yeah, in that sense, I was blessed to have my sister and my brother-in-law, because I knew they knew what I had, and I didn't have to know it. But I'll also say that it's so much of this internet age and mm-hmm. learning what your prognosis is. I think it's important to make informed decisions, but on the other hand, there's a risk of putting too much weight on statistics, because after all, they're not foolproof, as was proved by me. So,
Clearly. All right, folks, yeah. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for us to go through the triathlon with you. That just sounds incredibly daunting. Folks, you're listening to the voice of Lisa Reisman, who is the author of 5 months, 10 years, 2 hours, her struggles, her battles, her resilience, and her sort of bursting with life at a time when well past a time when many people said she would not be alive at all. We'll be right back. Lisa, you write in your book about a triathlon. Now, that just seems to be a fairly daunting pursuit. What brought you to the decision to pursue that experience?
I don't actually remember. What I can say about that time in my life was that I didn't have a lot going on. And I was sort of, I had just moved to Connecticut. I didn't have many friends. And I just wanted to come up with something, something that would challenge me, mm-hmm. something that I could do. I had no thought. It just happened to be on my 10-year anniversary. I had no thought that it would sort of, those two events would coincide.
Uh-huh.
I was just looking for something that would challenge me. I've always been very active, and so this seemed like something I'd like to try.
And try it you did.
I did.
Talk about your preparation for the triathlon.
Well, I did a lot of research.
Okay.
And so I joined a swimming club, and I sort of learned how to swim properly. And as I became sort of there, let me back up. I was a runner from way back in seventh grade, and I used to keep a training diary, and I would write down exactly how many miles, how long it took, what were my goals for the next day. So I did the same thing with a triathlon.
Okay.
And it was exciting because the stronger I got, like I remember one day when I had run 5 miles and swam in the Long Island Sound and then biked, and I just thought, wow, I can't believe my body can do this. So it was pretty cool to watch my body get stronger and stronger. And it was only after I did it that I realized that I was in some way trying to prove to myself that I was well, that my body was sort of at the apex of fitness.
I go back to that initial moment when you received the diagnosis and where you were when you pursued the triathlon and where you are today. And it seems like you have come so far and crossed so many incredible hurdles. What do you think that says about you as a human being, that you've been able to do so much?
Well, I'm not sure. I just live day by day, and I'm lucky to have a job I love, and I'm lucky to be able to stay active, and I'm not sure what it says about me, except it goes back to what my cross-country coach said,
mm-hmm.
that I just try to, if anything seems sort of unattainable, I just step back and I try to think, okay, how can I break this up? How can I make this into little tiny goals that I can eventually get to the end of? So I think that's just my mindset. And honestly, I don't think I did anything I think I did what I had to do. So I think there are people far more brave than me. And for example, I think people who are facing, I never was told that I had an inoperable brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
I never was told that my cancer was metastasizing. I never was told that I had a degenerative disease. I think people facing that are forced to show much more bravery. And I don't think I triumphed over anything, because I feel as if I hadn't lived, would I have lost the battle? Would people say I didn't show courage? And I think in many ways, people who are facing those kinds of hopeless, incurable diseases show bravery. There's a beautiful quote by Atul Gawande, the medical writer from Harvard.
Mm.
And let me make sure I get it right. The aim is not the good death, but a good life to the very end.
Mm.
So I think about someone who might have had an inoperable brain tumor. If that person did whatever he or she could do to live a good life to the very end, to make sure that their family was taken care of, to just tell everyone, have fun, have a great life, thank you so much, I had a great life, that to me is much more of a triumph than what I did.
Well, I hear you, and I mm-hmm. get that, but I would just like to suggest that for many people who, whether it is a brain tumor or some other thing that seems fairly daunting in their lives, mm-hmm. to read your story and to hear about you putting yourself on a schedule, changing your diet, doing your brain exercises, you know, all, finding something to find purpose in your life is mm-hmm. really quite rewarding and encouraging for many people. And I get that you don't see it in the same way, but I would just like to suggest that you are a hero for many people and will continue to be so for those who read your book.
Well, thank you so much, Pamela. That's so kind of you to say.
Let me ask you this. I don't hear you talking about support groups. I don't hear you talking about therapy. Did you do any of that?
I didn't. I decided the only way I could get well was I didn't do support groups. I'm not against support groups, but the only way I could get well was by acting as if I were well. And I'm going to go back to what something else my cross country coach once told us, that if you're running past a snarling dog, pretend you don't see it, don't change your pace, just keep going. So the way that and this was not a conscious decision, this is just what I did. I decided to totally sort of create a gulf between myself and the cancer world and cancer mm. people, as mm-hmm. I thought of them. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do whatever I could to live as if I were well, because and that was the only way that I could go on.
And that's what worked for you.
That's what worked for me. That's what worked for me. Support groups can be wonderfully helpful for other people, but that's something I couldn't do.
Tell us where you are today in your life. What's going on?
Well, I'm a reporter for the local paper here. I'm active. I manage a band. And I'm well.
Well, the name of this band is kind of interesting, the Sin Sisters Band. Do you want to talk to us about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you the story of how I found them. I walked into the pocket-sized post office in my town, and I heard Aretha Franklin's Rock Steady blaring from the radio, and I love that song. I absolutely love that song. I use it to help me get through workouts. Then suddenly, this woman in sky blue USPS uniform showed up, and I told her, I said, I love this song. And she said, I'm in a band. You should come out and hear us Saturday night. So I did. And I didn't take any... I told her that I reported for the local paper, but I didn't take any notes that night. I just danced, because they're this amazing group of musicians, and they do everything from swing to Motown to Top 40. The name comes from the three women vocalists in the band. They all went to Catholic school, and they all grew up together. So that's sort of a little... trick on words on the Catholic school experience.
Gotcha.
But they're just delightful, and it's so much fun.
So today your life is very full. You're doing what you love in all areas of your life.
Yes, I mean, I think what I want to say is that this is going to refer to the 10 years in the title, that. Everyone always says that getting a really serious disease gives you perspective, but you know, when you come out of it, you have to face all the messy, complicated parts of life. Mm. And so I remember just being so, thinking it was so unfair when I'd lose my sunglasses, or you know, I'd get this bill that was wrong, and I'd just say, haven't I been through enough? Haven't I struggled enough? Mm. Well, so I would say about this about my life now, that life is still a struggle. You know, every day is not perfect, but you get through it. So that's the takeaway that I hope people get from my book.
Well, I think that is actually the least of the takeaway that they will get from your book. Life is a struggle. You do get through it. The idea that you decided for yourself that you were going to live your life as though you had a life to live is, in fact, it sounds like what really helped you to do just that, to have that life to live, that the power of how we think about ourselves is tremendous, and I think it certainly comes through in your book. So I absolutely want to thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
It's been my pleasure, Pamela.
And again, folks, the name of the book, 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours, authored by Lisa Reisman. I think it's a book that anyone will enjoy. Maybe not enjoy, maybe that's not the word. Maybe it's be touched by, be moved by, maybe even have your life focus shifted a little bit. Again, 5 Months, 10 Years, 2 Hours, Lisa Reisman. And folks, I would like to thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. You can also listen to Mind Talk on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. The managing producer for Mind Talk is Jim Brown in 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. For more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org. And remember, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.